The Guardian.
The recordings will be made available to you through a national newspaper. 7 of John le Carré's explosive tales of espionage in audiobook format. Details of the first download, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, will be revealed in The Guardian on Saturday, and of the second, Our Kind of Traitor, in The Observer on Sunday. Hello? Is there someone on the line? 7 free John le Carré audiobooks to download starts this weekend as part of The Guardian and Observer book season.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead. Traveller's Tales.
Journeys to the Known.
Venice, Jan Morris.
It is very old and very grand and bent-backed. Its towers survey the lagoon in crotchety splendour, some leaning one way, some another. Its skyline is elaborate with campaniles, domes, pinnacles, cranes, rigging, television aerials, crenellations, eccentric chimneys, and a big red grain elevator. There are glimpses of flags and fretted rooftops, marble pillars, and cavernous canals.
And the Unknown.
Bruce Chatwin.
An ocean of grass extends westwards from Manchuria to the Hungarian plain. Over its undulating horizons, mounted nomads moved their flocks on a restless search for food. They were squat men, glued from childhood to their horses, their faces as red as their leather boots. The elements, which had hardened them, produced an inflexible attitude of mind. Without provocation, their mounted horsemen would swoop on farmsteads like flocks of crows, spatter the countryside with their blood, truss up their loot, and disappear into fogs.
Gap Year Adventure.
At Kwame Travel and Cruises, your travel is our priority. Whether it's a vacation package...
Set sail and drift into another world. It's about more than what happens at sea.
What I did on my holidays.
What makes the Philippines more than the usual holiday destination?
There's nothing like the sunrise, that first wave of the day.
Bermuda.
Welcome to the cradle of civilization. Explore Jordan with Indus Travel.
Some say when the gods created a Philippine island, they liked it so much, they decided to create 7,000 more. What they say about you.
There's no substitute for actually being there on the ground, experiencing it. Young people, I think, are finding that in particular. Travel is still a great rite of passage for the gap year student.
A Hitchhiker's Guide. Great railway journeys.
Join STA Travel, the world's largest travel company for students and teachers. London, $381.
Quite a lot. As we've got to New Zealand, we've done about like 20 activities.
Skiing, snowboarding.
Surfing, skydiving.
Leave ordinary behind. And there's no telling what you might find in the US Virgin Islands.
I'm Colin Thuban, and I'll be talking about my book, To a Mountain in Tibet, which was published earlier this year in February. The book was basically the account of a short, charged journey I made the year before in 2009 through Nepal and over the Tibetan border to Mount Kailash, the Buddhist holy mountain. And it was a journey in part made in memory of my family, who had all died. And so there was a personal element to it as well, a little bit unusual for my work, which is rather impersonal, I've been accused of. So it was an almost a diary-like account of a journey to a holy mountain.
Colin, you've been described as one of the last of the gentlemen travellers. Do you accept that nomination?
I don't know quite what it means. I'm not insulted by it too much, because I think there was a line of travellers in my youth that I admired, like Patrick Leigh-Fermor, Robert Barron. These people, I think, who were considered to have, yes, travelled in rather more gentlemanly fashion than I do, but they did a lot of research. I think this was one of the... It was a slower pace of journey than we're accustomed to now. Gentlemanly in that sense. Gentlemanly in the other sense I don't like, which Robert Barron is a great victim of, which is of a great air of superiority to those amongst whom you're travelling, and travelling with a retinue, which I've virtually never done. So there are things which make me uncomfortable about it, but on the whole, if it means a sort of a fascination with the world that you have attempted to have some knowledge of, then I'd like to think that I tried to belong to it anyway.
Has the means in which you've travelled changed over the years?
Not very much, I think. I've always travelled alone. I've always travelled, if I can, sort of on foot, or utilising the public transport of the countries I'm in, which throws you in with the people of the country. I've always tried, if I can, to, in a way, be reliant on the people among whom I'm travelling, for their hospitality, for their guidance, and for the information about themselves. I think the main effort in my research has been language. I've struggled to learn Russian and Mandarin, both of which I speak very badly, but in order to communicate with ordinary people, and that hasn't changed.
Tell us a bit about the particular challenges of Tibet for you.
The challenges were physical, altitude sickness in particular. I was moving through western Nepal, a very remote area, which had once been overrun by Maoist guerrillas, over the border to Tibet, to this very desolate part of Tibet called Nagari. And in that area is Mount Kailash, this beautiful holy mountain. But it's the main pass around the mountain is 18,600 feet, and that's high. And I didn't know whether I'd get altitude sickness or not. And there was a lot of physical strain. I mean, I'm not young, to say the least. And I worried that I would eventually be assailed by headaches and not be able to complete the journey.
You also have an amazing knack of picking parts of the world that then hove into view later on. Your first book in 1967 was about Damascus, which of course is now absolutely centre of the news. Tell us a little bit about that and how you pick your places.
It's a rather cliche, but I feel the places pick me. I suppose what's happened to me, the trajectory of my writing, has been first a fascination with the Middle East, which was a romantic fascination. I think I didn't understand anything about the old Arab culture, became riveted as a student by the inland cities of Syria, which I visited. And so Damascus was, like all my books, I think, an exercise in trying to understand something for myself, as well as for the reader. It's not as if I felt I knew about these places and was telling the reader about them. It's more a process of understanding, and that's what the journeys are about. I chose those places in the Middle East, Cyprus, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Damascus, out of this romantic ignorance, if you like, of what they were about. Later, for whatever reason, I changed and went to those countries which my generation was brought up to be afraid of. In other words, the great Soviet Union and China, communist China, looming behind, the countries that were supposed to come west and subsume us one day. And I wanted to understand them, to put a sort of human face to them. Not, I'd say, for my readers. It wasn't quite as respectable as that. It was really for myself. I wanted to try to, in some way, comprehend and humanise countries that we were mainly served up as sort of journalistic clichés of countries that were rather inhuman to us then. And so that became the main project, I suppose, of my life. These great areas of Asia, Siberia, Western Russia, China, Central Asia, had this fascination, again, a fascination of the unknown.
Would you go back to the Arab world? Because obviously an awful lot of history has happened since you wrote about them.
I think I might. I'm not sure. An awful lot's happened, which makes them almost, well, hard for me to re-engage with, in a way. I've been so long away from them. It might be. My next book's a novel, because I write novels between the travel books, and so I don't know what's going to happen after the novel.
And I'd like to just open it out a little bit and ask you about where you think travel writing's going. It seems to me that it went through a bit of a slump in the 90s, and now there seems to be a new generation of travel writers who are using travelogue as part of slightly different stories, for example, The Hare with Amber Eyes.
Yes, I was lucky in as much as travel writing in the early 80s was suddenly became popular as a literary genre. There was Bruce Chatwin, there was Paul Theroux, that still is, Jonathan Raban, Redmond O'Hanlon, and I, you know, was lucky to be part of that generation. And then, yes, I think it was overpublished in one way. It typically, you know, the publishing world does this. They discover a genre that's suddenly popular, then they publish too many rather bad books as well as the good ones, and the genre begins to lose its freshness and appeal. Now, I think there's less a feeling that travel writing is about, or at least the interesting new travel, it's less about finding new places, as perhaps digging beneath the surface of the places that apparently are familiar, are westernized, but in fact aren't, of course. You could say of China that it's not, it hasn't been westernized at all. It's just sort of sinicized the West or turned the West Chinese. And that's a great challenge for travel writers now, is to see under the apparently homogeneous surface. And travel, it's everywhere, in effect. I think people, after a period of thinking that you could sort of travel virtually, you could see it on the screen, you could access it at any time on your computer, again, maybe realizing that actually there's no substitute for actually being there on the ground, experiencing it. Young people, I think, are finding that in particular. Travel is still a great rite of passage for the gap year student to test themselves in countries that are profoundly different from ours.
Is there a part of the world that you would love to discover that you feel you have not yet discovered?
Actually, I've never travelled in sub-Saharan Africa. I don't know Black Africa at all, and I'd like to go there before I'm dead.
The great Colin Thubron there. With me here now in the studio are Mike Carter, who has recently published his second travel book, One Man and His Bike, and Veronica Horwell, who is of the Thubron School and prefers to travel on foot. Our colleagues, meanwhile, on The Guardian's travel section have also been hard at work gathering recommendations from some of the finest contemporary travel authors. This is quite a vintage selection, isn't it, Veronica?
It's vintage, but it also contains some surprising entries.
Paul Theroux picked The Worst Journey in the World by Apsley Cherry Girard. What do you think about that?
I absolutely adore that book. He was part of the Scott Antarctic Expedition. He got out in one piece, just with a few teeth that exploded from 40, 50 and Lord knows how many degrees of cold. He was going there for science. He went through enormous sufferings and privations with a sense of lightheartedness and with an overwhelming curiosity and glee that just jumps at you off the pages.
Now, Mike, you were jumping up and down when you saw that Laurie Lee's As I Walked Out One Summer Morning had been picked a few times. Is that really a travel book?
Oh, I think so. I think in some ways it's the quintessential travel book. Young man leaves his Cotswold village for the first time, puts a backpack on and starts walking. How much more travel could you possibly want? Not actually just physically journeying, but through his emotional development as well, and walking to London and then taking himself to Spain, and then walking across Spain with the backdrop of the Civil War.
These choices are quite dominated by men, aren't they, Veronica? I mean, is there a difference between the way women and men write travel?
Yes, I think there is. The classic example of this are the alternative versions of a journey from the far west of China down through the Taklamakan Desert and over the Hindu Kush into what was then British India. One of the people who wrote about this was Peter Fleming, and the other one was a woman called Ella Mayart. And they wrote alternative versions of the same story. His is a thrilling tale and with a clear adventure narrative. In Ella Mayart's, much less happens, very much more realistically. And I always think the great principle is that Peter Fleming would, and indeed did, let his camels die for the sake of the story. And Ella Mayart would not have let a single camel go sick.
Rory MacLean cites Nicholas Bouvier's The Way of the World, which is about travelling across Asia, published in the 1960s, and said it set waves of young Europeans on the road, which is actually quite important, isn't it? Because travel writing's not just for eccentrics who go off on their own.
The most important thing is that it makes people want to take the first step in the journey of 1,000 miles. It has only got to impel them to bicycle down the road.
Ah, which brings us very neatly back to Mike. Mike, now you're not going to be too insulted if I describe you as an eccentric who goes off on his own, are you? I mean, you've done these two huge bike journeys. First was on a motorbike and the second was on a pedal bike.
Mm.
Your first book, Uneasy Riders, subtitled Travel Through a Midlife Crisis.
Well, it was about owning the cliche of being a man in his 40s who didn't really know what to do with himself. And it was either get a sports car, a kind of 18-year-old girlfriend, or a motorbike. It seemed to me they were the options available. So I thought the motorbike was probably the more sensible option. But I'd never ridden a motorbike before, but I made this promise to people, having had a few drinks. And the only plan I had was to go to Calais and turn left. And that was it. It's a constant battle to pull yourself back into the moment and say, well, where feels right? Mm-hmm. You know, where should I go? Where do I want to go? Disseminating information. And so I tried to be pure to that when I was on the motorbike journey and, you know, take recommendations from people on the road or look for signs. And that's kind of the way I like to travel. I really don't like to know where I'm going to be on the evening of the morning when I set off.
Your second book, you were on your bike,
yeah.
Which means that you're much closer to the beginning of your journey by the evening of your journey, aren't you? It's a much slower process. And you went round the coast of Britain.
Of Britain, yeah. I set off. The idea came when I was commuting to The Guardian one day on my bicycle, and I got to Blackfriars Bridge, where I would ordinarily turn left. And I think I'd probably had a dreadful commute that morning. I'd been sworn at and nearly knocked off, and it was raining or something. And I thought, you know what, if I don't turn left and carry on straight at this traffic light, we live on an island. As long as I keep the sea on my right, I eventually have to get back to this exact point. It was a lovely idea. So a couple of weeks later, I did just that. I was on my normal commute route to work with luggage this time. And I pedaled and pedaled and pedaled. And 5 months later and 5,000 miles later, I got back to that exact point of Blackfriars Bridge. And there was something wonderful about completing a circle of one's own homeland and seeing every inch of the coastline.
I'm going to pursue the bicycle. We've got Dervla Murphy, a young lady who pursued her education on a bicycle.
Hers is an unsentimental education. And it was made possible by the fact that she realised to a certain extent you cannot walk your way out of trouble as a woman. But in places where there weren't, in her beginning days, very many bicycles, you could pedal your way out of trouble pretty fast.
It helped to have a revolver in your saddlebag as well.
Of course, yes, but the foot came first. That was last resort.
Is it there's something slightly comic about the idea of a bloke on a bike pedalling around the whole of the country? Is the bike a talking point with people you met?
I found motorcycles not terribly conducive to people approaching you. I think it's something about the speed and the helmet and these other things. You're not terribly visible or terribly approachable. But it soon became apparent to me in that first day that being on a bicycle actually draws people to you like a moth to a flame. It's extraordinary. Every time I would stop for a banana or a flapjack, which was the fuel of choice on the road, people would come and look at the luggage and say, "Where are you going?" And I'd say, well, I'm cycling around Britain. And wide-eyed, they'd ask me a few more questions. And so within 5 minutes, instantaneously, we were in a dialogue. And then, of course, I could ask them lots of questions about their lives in a way that would be inconceivable if we were just, you know, strangers on the tube. I'm convinced that in a tube carriage in London, we're so nosy and so gregarious human beings that we're desperate for information from each other.
Everybody travels now. Mm. Is it interesting? Are there any more travellers' tales to be told? What do you feel about that? You're part of a throng now.
A throng. I think as a writer, there's active looking, active listening. I think when I go on holiday, I'm a kind of a different creature from when I'm doing a trip for a book or a piece, is that I force myself to look in a slightly different way, I think. And I teach travel writing as well, and I urge my students to carry a notebook with them and walk in a way that's active and listen in a way that's active.
Because you're not doing this only for yourself. That's a huge and satisfying reward. Mm. But you're doing it to communicate to other people what they may not have seen, what they may not even know they can see.
Mike, would you just like to leave us with... You're a mine of quotes, aren't you? Great travel quotes. H.G. Wells. Give us some H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells once wrote that every time I see an adult riding a bicycle, I have hope for the future of mankind. And I didn't really understand that fully before, and I don't really understand it fully now, to be honest. But there is something about... especially, I think, in the 21st century, or certainly through the second half of the 20th century, about a human adult riding a bicycle, which is something we learn to ride as a child and expands our boundaries beyond where we can walk. And I think the bike grants most of us our first view of a world beyond those narrow confines of our neighbourhood and the possibility of travel.
But I want to just bring this back to London, and a bit of very sad topical news to tell you about, which is that the travel bookshop in Notting Hill, the one that was immortalised in the film of the same name, has just closed, having failed to find a buyer to bail it out. So obviously the ways of spreading this literature is going to have to change, and booksellers have actually been taking quite a bit of initiative in this. We took a trip down to Daunt's bookshop in London to see how they have been linking travel guides with travel writing and then linking on with literature.
Hello, I'm Brett Wollstonecroft. I'm the manager of Daunt Books here in Marylebone High Street. This is our original shop here, an original Edwardian bookshop. One that probably focuses more than any of the others on travel, on place, just almost completely by country, bar, you know, a more general section at the front of the shop. We're doing this 22 years ago now. In many ways, publishing has moved our way, us having to change, so we're very much still as we are. For us, this was all about the interesting connections you can get between books if you're not restricted by either publisher or A to Z listings on a shelf. So here you can have an author and you can put a biography right next to it, which I think is the way most of us make those kind of connections. You can also put cookery, you can put the travel writing there with it. You can get a whole cultural hinterland to a place when you look at a shelf. Now, I think that works when you're travelling. You want to read a novel set somewhere or buy an author from that country, but it also works for armchair travelling, and indeed for people who aren't travelling, in that you've got all sorts of different ways of discovering books. Bookshops should be about surprises, and that is one way that it works well for us.
Let's take one country.
We could pick almost anything you like really here, but perhaps if we started with sort of, you know, Central Europe, Czech and Slovak republics, I mean, you've got your usual range of guidebooks, The Lonely Planets, The Rough Guides, The Dawning Kindles, The Eyewitnesses, all these things. Probably more guidebooks still than when we started out, even if people have begun to look at things on the net. But it means you can put down wonderful writers like Karol Čapek, Bohumil Hrabal, as well as perhaps people who we would all recognise, like Kundera and Kafka. You can put all these in there. You've got accounts of places. You've got this series here, Cities of Imagination, Peter Demitz's fabulous book, Prague in Black and Gold. You can really get the whole portrait of Central European history really out of one section. There isn't a huge amount at the moment on the history just of the Czech and Slovak republics. And these shelves do change. They reflect, you know, particular interests. It's still the case that over in Germany, though you'll find lots more literature in translation, you still don't find enough. You still find an overpreponderance of history, obviously the Second World War, beginning to be redressed a bit. Fabulous books like the German genius, Peter Watson's book, Simon Winder's book on Germania, a good look at the Germans as a people and as a country. But we rather like the way in which these shelves shift and change. They're rather like sand in that they flow into our own obsessions and those of publishers and those of the wider world. Travel writing is a very different thing now to, you know, the days when you went off and discovered yourself as well as the country, as it were. So it's changed a great deal.
And there is still room for any exploration?
I think there's room for a great deal of exploration. I think the problem is that we've all seen images of almost anywhere in the world, and that is the great difficulty. Oxfam just recently published a fantastic anthology of travel called Ox Travels. And that really is just a collection of meetings, of great writers writing about meetings. And there I think you can see the sort of, you know, the worth and the future in a way of travel writing, in that it's just two people, but you're getting a clash between East and West, or the former Soviet Union, and who wanted a very different kind of life. All sorts of connections like that are made, and that's where you can get a wonderful amount of enjoyment out of travel writing.
So in the spirit of Daunt's Bookshop, let's now talk to a novelist who uses travel experiences to find his subject matter.
Hi, I'm Edward Dox, and I'm at the Edinburgh Festival, and my talk was about my third novel, The Devil's Garden, which has just been published by Picador, which is set in the Amazon, and it was a discussion about the use of place in the novel. I wrote my third novel in counterpoint to my second. My second novel had been a story of a family, half English, half Russian, and it had been largely set in London, Paris, and a little bit in St. Petersburg, where my mum originally came from. And I wanted to get away from that kind of familial story and go down a different kind of tradition of English writing, which is the tradition that goes via kind of Golding and Green. And I know Conrad's not English, but he wrote in English, goes back that way. And so I wanted to slim down and kind of do a chamber music piece. And that took me to the Amazon, because it also gave me a very, very tight location. It's all set on a river station, so people can't get off.
Your jungle's in South America rather than Africa, but you've already mentioned Conrad. Was he a presence who was guiding you, or was he very much an evil spirit to avoid in the jungle?
I'd been on a press trip, actually, to the jungle during the writing of the second novel, The South American Jungle, and when it came to write the third one, I'd met this guy who was studying ants, and he was a fascinating human being. And I'd also heard a story about an anthropologist who disappeared in terrifying circumstances. And then I did read the Conrad again. And my own work is completely not influenced by it, except in one significant way, which is midway through my book, The Devil's Garden, one of the characters says, "There's nothing here to find, there's nothing left in the jungle." And that is a direct harking back to the Conrad, because the Conrad idea of the human spirit, the essence of man, is somewhere hiding in the jungle, and that if we can get back to that kind of primitive, unfallen self, we'll find redemption. My guy, it's the opposite. The world has changed. You can Google map the entire Earth. There is nowhere to hide. We must face ourselves.
I was wondering if the criticisms that have been made, Chinua Achebe speaks particularly of Conrad's problems with the black characters in the book. I wondered whether those criticisms were in the back of your mind when you were dealing with how you would confront the native people that your characters come across in your own novel.
That's a great question. I spent a lot of time down there, and I also spent a lot of time reading anthropology. And anthropology, I think, is the answer to all questions of race. Because once you start to read about it, you discover that the current thinking is there was a tribe of roughly 200, 250, no more, Homo sapiens who left North Africa, from which we are all of us, on the whole planet, genetically descended, unless you're from Africa. And so once you realise the kinship of humanity is that simple, and genetically proven to be that simple, for me anyway, all questions of race become nonsensical. We are absolutely one family, and one very small family, and I find it almost alarming and very, very disappointing that anthropology is not taught in schools.
I wasn't accusing you of being a racist. what I meant was, did you feel that it was necessary to consciously make space for native characters to speak in their own words in your book?
I did. I mean, my novel tries very hard to represent all points of view on the compass. So there is a man who's busy exploiting the jungle for oil. There's a guy who's busy saving the jungle from that. There's a guy who's dealing in drugs, cocaine, which is what happens in Peru. There are the tribes, the Matsigenka, and also the Ashaninka tribesmen in the novel. And what I wanted to do was write a novel of humanity whereby all of those points on the compass are in dispute, as they actually are down there. And what's great and interesting, I think, about the Amazon, it's a very human nexus. Everything is live there, whether or not we're going to legalise cocaine, whether or not we're going to get more oil out of the jungle, whether or not we're going to save the jungle. Are we going to integrate the Native American Indians? Are we not? Are we going to put them in reserves? Is that our right? Should we be doing that? Should we not be doing that? Who calls those shots? And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to write an anatomy of the situation as it now occurs, rather than take sides, which I know is a very kind of Graham Greene-y ambition. It's an ambition to stay out of it morally. And I certainly wanted to do that. I wanted to, if you like, give a snapshot of the Peruvian Amazon as it appears now.
Is this unashamedly a novel of ideas then?
I think the word author is very close to the word authenticity. And one of the things you can do as a writer is you can make sure that the work itself is authentic. That's the best you can do. So you don't doubt that it definitely is, you know, the Amazon basin. You don't doubt his science. You don't doubt that I know what I'm talking about in those things. And I try to always do that. I did it with the second book in Russia. I went there a lot. And, you know, some writers write books never having gone anywhere and they're brilliant. Other people spend 8 years researching. There's no right way. But for me, trying to make sure that I know what I'm talking about before I begin the story is very important. So it's a combination between characters and their worlds built, and then once you've got their worlds, if he's a scientist, that's going to bring in Darwinism, that's going to bring in genetics, and then because he's down there, there's going to be anthropologists, you bring that in, and then because there's drugs there, you bring those. So hopefully it's an organic process.
Edward Dock's talking there to Richard Lee about The Devil's Garden, which is published by Picador. And finally, From Journeys Around the World to a Journey Through the Mind. Performance artist Bobby Baker travelled into mental illness and then out again. The drawings that she did during that period have been exhibited all round the country and beyond, and the book that came out of it, Diary Drawings, Mental Illness and Me, has just won the annual prize awarded by the charity Mind. Previous winners include Hilary Mantel, Janice Galloway and Studs Terkel. So now, just by way of introduction, I wondered if you would mind reading the very first, your actual introduction in Diary Drawing.
My name is Bobby Baker. I am a woman and an artist. I am 58 years old. I studied painting at St Martin's School of Art, now Central St Martin's, from 1968 to 72. And became a performance artist, in inverted commas, on leaving college. I met my husband, Andrew Whittock, a professional photographer, in the 1990s, and we have two children, a daughter and a son. Following the birth of our children, we had many good years, but in 1996, things started to unravel for me. In the following year, an NHS consultant psychiatrist told me that I had a borderline personality disorder. I had not heard that term before, but I was indignant. I was, in my view, distressed beyond anything I imagined it possible for a human being to be and remain alive. I replied firmly, "I beg your pardon, but speak for yourself." The 158 carefully selected drawings that follow tell the private story from 1997 to 2008 of my somewhat lengthy journey to full recovery.
Thank you very much. Now, as you would gather from that introduction, family plays a big part in this. It's co-authored with your daughter, Dora.
Well, we curated the exhibition together. This book has emerged from an exhibition at Wellcome Collection, which we curated 158 drawings out of 711 I did during that period of 11 years. And Dora is now a clinical psychologist, which is quite handy. Have one in the family.
And Andrew did the photographs?
Yes, he photographed them. The drawings are all in sketchbooks, and I obviously didn't want to tear them up.
And last but not least, you've got a lovely foreword from your son Charlie, who was asked whether it was a good idea for you to go so public about something that was so private.
I have made work about myself, my own experience. You know, it's quite risky and sometimes a matter of concern and has to be discussed. So these drawings had been around. Initially, they were private. I never showed them to anyone. It turns out Dora would sneak looking at them to check up how I was, but because they went on so long and they would lie around the kitchen table, Charlie had sort of seen them, people knew them, and I showed them to various people and professionals. So finally I had to sort of batter him verbally for a response. "Oh, it's got to be done, Mum." Actually, in a sense, although it is a great exposure, I suppose for many people who go through experiences like that, you want something to come out of it that is sort of helps people learn or get hope, or but also maybe change things.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, it came out of an exhibition. This is a book, and it's in the context of its bookness that we are talking now. Yeah. And I'm really interested in the structure of it, because you structure it in stages.
You know, when you go through very extreme experiences or any journeys, they go on for a quite, you know, set period of time. And this was a long time, and there were many stories attached to it. And so what came out of the curating, I had a wonderful team of people I was working with about that to break it down. And I thought of the word stage because it felt like a sort of endurance test. And so, and I'm very keen on prime numbers. And in the end, you know, 17 was just about right, so there's 17 stages.
Stage 6, I particularly noted. You said it sounded like standing on the foothills of Mount Everest.
Oh, yeah, that's when I started getting this treatment called dialectical behaviour therapy. I'm rather critical. I critique everything that anyone ever suggests to me. And I said, you know, it's like being given a handout, tatty handouts in a carrier bag at the bottom of some mountain like Everest and being told to get up to the top. How do you possibly expect us to do that?
And then, of course, you have a picture of yourself with huge, great sacks on your back.
Quite often, actually, there's a lot of drawings I didn't select. I draw myself with great sacks on my back, yeah.
I begin to notice that when there's more purple, you're at a lower phase.
Oh, I hate purple. I'm sorry. I don't mind people who wear purple, but personally, it's my least favourite colour. When I was feeling really ill, I mean, I would call it dotty, there'd be like these purple women following me. Well, no, women in purple fleeces, which I don't think is a very strong fashion item, really. Oh, gosh, I shouldn't say that, but I just spot them and think, oh. But actually, I think the thing about going crazy or having bad times, your mind, because we're rational people, even at our worst moments, we're trying to make sense of why you feel so bad. And so, you know, psychosis or crazy thoughts can be a metaphor for suffering. So purple people were not a good sign.
And purple
for
me. Bags are particularly heavy and bulky when they're on your back.
Probably.
The other thing I absolutely love about this book is that I think of it as an expressionist masterpiece, because it is so much, it just is absolutely the bursting out of your most innermost fears and pain, really. But what's one thinks of expressionism in terms of very dark colours, perhaps, you know, Edvard Munch's The Scream or Kafka's work. But actually, your imagination is incredibly bright. So this is actually expressed. It's expressionism in incredibly bright colours.
Well, I went to St Martin's when it was the era of abstract expressionism. So, you know, Gillian Ayres and all that. So, I mean, I'm always very keen on colour. I did a lot of colour studies at college. So it's funny, I think, how those sort of influences, I don't see the world as a dark, dreary place. So colours are sort of code, I suppose, for me.
Let's just have a look through the book. We've got it here in front of us. Is there a part of it that's particularly vivid to you in terms of your journey?
I made a lot of friends on my journey in the mental health system, as we call it, in the system. This is of two friends. One of them, they came into the art room when I was at the day centre and said, well, we heard you went to art school. You better draw us then. Show us. It was sort of like a challenge. And I had to kind of show off, and I drew them. I painted with the most vivid colours.
It's sort of very, very watery, bright yellows, oranges, pale blues.
Yeah, it's got this wonderful cerulean blue. It was a very light day, you know, when you're in a dark place, light and bright moods and really good friendly people around. So I think it was a very joyful painting to paint, and the whole process of painting I found very delightful.
And that's it for our show this week. Do check out all the other bookish things we've got going on this weekend in our special book season. As I speak, Guardian staff are out planting 10,000 free books around the country for our very first book swap. With me is Craig Pursehouse, who's with us on Work Experience this week, who's going to be going up to Manchester to plant his book. What are you going to take, Craig?
I'm going to take China Mayville's The City and the City, which I've just finished. I'd never heard of him until I'd started Work Experience here. So in my second week, I went out and bought the book, and I really, really enjoyed it. So I'll be taking that up with me.
You can find more details of that on guardian.co.uk. And please do let us know if you find one of the books. I'm going to leave my very own copy of diary drawings by my local hospital, which is the Homerton in East London, on Saturday. Now, Craig, will you run us through some of the things, other things we've got coming up?
In Sunday's Observer, we're launching a competition for budding artists of 16 or under to design a brand new cover of the classic novel Lord of the Flies. For details of that, go to guardian.co.uk/childrensbooks.
And next week, we start the celebrations for Dickens's bicentenary. You might think this is a bit early since the date actually falls in February, but what the hell, we're getting ahead of the pack as usual. Do subscribe to this podcast on a regular basis and we'll keep you up to date on everything we're doing in the book season. You can do so on iTunes or at guardian.co.uk/books, where you can click on a podcast button at the top of the page. Many thanks to everyone who took part in this programme and not least to our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.